Kawhi Leonard's contract extension ruins free agency. We find a new home for DeJounte Murray, and the vibe check returns for the not-so-vibey Golden State Warriors. That and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room, the podcast where absolutely everything we say gets aggregated because it's trade season. My name is Jake Fisher. I'm a senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. And joining me as always, it's senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. It's my man. It's your man. It's everyone's man. It's Dan Devine. What's up?
I was trying to stay as still as possible because I saw how AJ Hawk was getting memed on the McAfee show. And I was like, this is maybe the pathway to me breaking through to a new audience. I'm doing great. It's an exciting time to be alive because I get to do a podcast with Jake Fisher and find out later that every piece of it was something that people found interesting and clipped out. Guys, I say interesting stuff too. It's not just Jake's reporting. You could totally put like that thing that I said on the Dunk Central about a guy's cleaning the glass numbers. Like that would be fine by me also. It's like, let's value both of us is all I'm saying. I feel a little bit left out, but I do not feel left out of the conversation that we are about to have. I'm excited to talk to you, Jake.
I'm always trying to include you. This would not be what this show would not
you
be
are.
What it is.
You're very inclusive. I appreciate
Thanks,
that.
Thanks, man. This show would not be what it is without my first mate on the NC Armada. So we got to just keep taking the ship to the stormy seas of the NBA, where today we are going to definitely talk more trade market, coaching market, and vibe check the just dilapidated Golden State Warriors. But first, news. Kawhi Leonard and the Clippers, out of nowhere, $152 million extension over 3 years. No options on that. Big effing news on the NBA landscape, being that we've already talked about this on this show before. It's definitely a conversation around the league that free agency is kind of dead. Guys just pick their mark on the map and they ask for a trade and they get there. Or if you're Donovan Mitchell, you have to go to Cleveland first. But I think largely, like, when's the last time we saw a guy flying around and taking meetings? Like, it was Gordon Hayward in 2017. There really hasn't been that. And I think this is a big blow to the Philadelphia 76ers of the world that were hoping that, oh, all this cap space that we could do could be a real massive chip in our belt. Because there's reports, and Paul George confirmed it last night at his locker, that they're working on an extension too. Turns out that James Harden trade might have worked out, Dan.
Yeah, no kidding. It means that people like me who are skeptical about it are, you know, eating a fair amount of crow right now. But with, of course, the giant caveat of we'll see where we are in 3-4 months. But yeah, I mean, it's the context for this is the Clippers have been an absolute like war machine for the last month or so, a couple of months, really, basically since they made the switch of Russell Westbrook getting out of the starting lineup and going to the bench, and they kind of locked into how they want to play. 14 wins in their last 15 games that Kawhi has played in. He has been like a top 10-ish player by like every advanced metric. He's played in 33 of their 37 games, so the load management and availability question has, at least for right now, been answered. Since they went to that starting lineup change, 25.5 points on 54, 44, 91 shooting while also playing like crazy defense. He's been one of the best players in the league, feels like a player or looks like a player that can be one of the best players on a championship team. And this was always what the Clippers were banking on. And, you know, as you mentioned, the big loser out of this could be just like anybody that wants to make a big swing on the free agent market. Because if you've got Kawhi locked down, Paul George potentially on the way, James Harden can't extend his contract because the CBA stuff, he had signed a 2-year deal in Philly. You'd only extend a deal that's 3 years or longer, but he's going to be an unrestricted free agent. Kawhi had said he thinks that this kind of means like everybody's on the way. Like, quote, with the conversation that I have with them about it, I think for the most part, everybody's coming back. So that's, you know, like if he's off the market too, then you're looking at like, I don't know, is LeBron going to go someplace? Maybe if Drew Holiday stays in Boston, OG Anunoby stays in New York, like it's maybe down to just Pascal Siakam as the needle mover. Maybe he winds up being the bell of the ball there. But as you mentioned, sort of if you're a team looking to make a big swing in free agency, hint, hint, Philadelphia 76ers, maybe this leads you to make a couple of decisions a little faster than you might want to, or look elsewhere rather than what you initially had on the big board. But great work for the Clippers. Everything has been absolutely turning up roses for them. And as we've seen throughout the history of the Clippers franchise, in no way could anything possibly go wrong from here.
Possibly. This is not us like sticking our finger out and going nanny nanny poo poo at Philly. Like, I just want that to be clear. Like, this is not, we both mentioned,
I mean, I can do that. We got a camera. I
just did it. It's just us connecting dots and like pulling out the thread and seeing where it could have connected later on. The other thing that, you know, when this news came out, I was on the phone with somebody, and Kawhi's played in 33 of 37 games so far this year, which is part of why the Clippers are so good and part of why the Clippers have been able to feel confident enough to do this extension. Because there was a time not too far ago in the rear view where the talk around the league was, do the Clippers even want to extend these guys? Like, they're both undependable about really just health stuff. And we've never really seen Kawhi in a full postseason run with the Clippers at all because of, so to your point, like, we'll see how it all works. But for right now, man, they've been cooking. I don't remember the specifics off the top of my head, but I saw a statistic recently where of all the top 10 teams in all the top 10 five-man lineups in net rating, the starting lineup that has the big three, and I guess let's put Zubac in there. The starting lineup, big three with Zubac, with either Terrence Mann or Norm Powell, both those two lineups are in the top 10 of net rating, which is a pretty nice juggernaut to have. Just, we've got this crew, we can switch out. We've got these, I mean, all the talk of the top six in Boston, which is very much an elite group. Clippers are right there, man. And that's not factoring Russ. That's not factoring Daniel Tice has been, I mean, that might go down depending on how big of a role he plays for them. Like, that might go down as one of the sneaky great moves of this. I'm just kind of riffing here, of the season, being that, I mean, they got him for nothing. That dude just got a buyout in the quiet of the night and left the IST Pacers to show up one day in LA, and now he's just like been there cooking in the second unit. So the Clippers are dangerous, man. They're scary.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to just add on to that, and you have conversations with lots of different kinds of people that I don't, and I'm wondering if this is something that's going to be, you know, bearing watching moving forward. And it's something that I saw a guy, my guy Ryan Bernardoni, Danger Cart on Twitter, he's a Celtics guy, but also very much a CBA and cap guy, mentioning that, like, it's interesting to monitor that the projected money that Kawhi is going to get in 2025, 26, 26, 27, about $50 million a year. So like $100 million in new money added onto this, his current contract. That represents a sub max deal for Kawhi Leonard at those ages, 34, 35 seasons. It'll be like 32% of the max or 29% of the max, something like that. But does this represent kind of the start of a shift under this new CBA environment of the, especially the aging stars, but superstar players, they're getting still, you know, huge money, but it's going to wind up, are we going to wind up seeing more sub max deals because free agents or franchises and presidents of basketball operations, et cetera, are able to kind of convince those players, like, listen, the second apron stuff is no joke. The way it limits our flexibility in terms of how we build the roster, how we make the most title competitive team we can.
Yeah,
you help us out by giving a few million back. And it's, you know, the reason that I think it's going to bear watching is it's literally something Lawrence Frank said in his comments about this, president of basketball operations for the Clippers. The quote was, Kawhi was a great partner. Because of this new CBA, there's harsh penalties and team building penalties for high spending teams, and Kawhi understood it. So, like, is that going to be somewhere where the negotiations, especially for these guys, you know, there's Kawhi, there's LeBron, there's Kevin Durant, there's Stephen Curry, these like aging up superstars that our pal Vinny Goodwill wrote about last week at Yahoo Sports. Does the way the dynamic shift of, it's just been those guys get whatever they want for as long as they want to get it because that's who they are in this league. Does that start to shift under this new dynamic? And what does that mean sort of downstream effects for other kinds of stars or other age groups or guys who are not quite stars or yada, yada, yada? How does that affect the team building dynamic moving forward? I think might be something to kind of watch. And Kawhi's deal here might be kind of the first one that starts things in motion.
Yeah, that's a really great point, being that if you are an all-NBA, all-star player in a contending situation where you're banging on the table for your front office to do something to make your team better, like we see all the time, if the front office says to some guys, hey, well, it'd be a lot easier to do that if you had taken $5 million less, like we had said. Now, it's certainly possible. I do think, though, that would be much more likely to occur in situations like this, where it is older teams that are in the contending sphere, where guys have made $100, $200 million already in their pocket, compared to, I mean, I went to the Nets Thunder game on Friday, and there was an agent I was speaking with who was just very much running down the list of his players who are coming up this summer and trying to see how much they could get. And, you know, that's the big context around Pascal Siakam right now, where he, by various accounts to me, it seems that the number one leading principle for his approach to this trade deadline, to how that compares with the opportunities that are going to be out there this summer on free agency, that like getting the max and the top dollar that he can get is the priority. So I think, yes, in certain scenarios where the going's been going well and it's about maintaining a contender for the long haul, absolutely. But I think you will still see those solo actors who are a businessman and not a businessman, or whatever you want to do it. And they're going to want their top dollar because they're thinking about, well, I didn't make $200 million in my prime already. This is my opportunity. I'm reaching the market now. I'm timing this perfectly. There's three teams who want me, all that type of stuff. So that's a great thought. But I don't think it'll be a uniform trend across. Maybe we'll see Steph or whoever, but maybe we'll see that happen in Denver when the next contracts come up and the Nuggets are still kicking, or if things go well in Minnesota. That's all the talk but about the Wolves, right? How will they be able to keep this together with new ownership coming in, questions about abilities to finance things? Although I haven't read about it in full detail, but the Wolves did bring on this minority owner. I forget his name off the top of my head. I think it's Eric Schmidt or something, who was with Google, who's like richer than any other NBA owner than Steve Ballmer. So I'm now starting to wonder if any of those questions, this is like a total tangent. Wonder if any of those questions about the Wolves ownership, financing, whatever, if they have any like richer than anyone than Steve Ballmer money coming in their side pocket. So we'll see about that. But to go to the trade market here, as we started to broach with some Pascal stuff, we're going to leave the Raptors a bit on the side. We've talked to plenty of Raptors. I did a Twitter Spaces about the Raptors. I can't talk anymore about the Raptors right now. Tyrese Halliburton got hurt, unfortunately. Did a little split ski on the court. Didn't look too comfortable. Didn't, and I like Tyrese a lot. Didn't look like it necessarily needed to be carried off the court either. I'm just going to say that. That was a little bit something.
Your fraud allegations for Tyrese Halliburton? Is this like a Paul Pierce in the wheelchair kind of thing?
Yeah, it was I don't know. And look, he's their savior and he's been anointed. And I mean, I would carry him a kid. If I was Jairus Walker, whoever carried him off the court, I would lift him off the court too. I'd be a good teammate. I would do that. From the outside looking in, it was looked a little silly. Anyway, he's been ruled out for roughly 2 weeks. We'll see what happens more. I think the fact that it was originally like an undetermined timeline, yes, a lot of people around the league were wondering how will this change Indiana's approach to the deadline. They've been talked a lot about one of the most active, aggressive pursuers. They were in on OG Anunoby at the end. They still are a team that keeps being mentioned about Pascal. I don't think, I mean, knock on wood, as much as I don't want, or made a little joke about the carry off the court thing, like, don't want Tyrese Halliburton to suffer a long-term injury, of course. Good dude, really good player. If it was a longer-term thing, I would be curious to see how that would have changed. Like, if he was Ja Morant all of a sudden out for the year type stuff, I'd be curious to see what was going to happen to Indy. But the Pacers, much because they believe that Ty is a guy who can lead them deep into the playoffs now, like he did in the in-season tournament, and Rick Carlisle has famously never really wanted to be overseeing, you know, daycare with the kids. He's wanted to really compete with veterans. I mean, their number 8 pick from this lottery has not played significant time at all this season, while he plays the position that they have continued to scour the market for, defensive-minded foremen. I think that's still what the task is for Indiana. I've still been searching and looking. I mean, I keep hearing Andrew Wiggins' name there. Shout out anyone who wants to take that and put that on social media. Like, I think Jonathan Kuminga was also, I know Jonathan Kuminga was also another Warriors player that the Pacers have been keeping tabs on and calling Golden State about dating back to last draft. So those are two potential options. I mean, we've talked about Pascal. Go down the list of any defensive-minded power forward athlete, you know, someone who could probably add some shooting to. They're going to be on Indiana's wish list. I don't think this changes things. I think they still have this goal of trying to compete for it. I mean, Rick Carlisle said it on the record in his press conference in Vegas at T-Mobile Arena that when you have someone like Tyrese Halliburton, it makes you think that championships are possible.
And they're not all that far away from being the kind of complete team that could go for it. I mean, they're wildly lopsided. We know that. League best offense built really around Tyrese Halliburton scoring and playmaking and the three-point shooting, the threat of everything he opens up, and one of the worst defenses in the league. But the thing that they're missing, you're absolutely right, and it's why they were so heavily in on OG Anunoby. It's why that player type makes such a huge difference. They just don't have that. And like I wrote this on Twitter the other night. It's like a very basic observation, but you watch the Knicks and you watch OG Anunoby defend on the perimeter and you're like, oh, right. All the other guys they had were too small for that. Like they were trying to make Josh Hart or Quentin Grimes or RJ Barrett. Yeah. Like all of those guys were just like several inches too small to do the job the way that the Knicks needed it to be done. And you're talking about very much the same thing in Indiana, where it's like Aaron Nesmith is a good defensive player with great athleticism and a great motor. He's just 6'5". And like Andrew Nembhard is a good defensive guard who can do multiple things for you. It's just he's a little bit too small for that kind of job. And so whoever the next names down on that list are, I think Kuminga and Wiggins are interesting ones, especially given the way things are going in Golden State, which we'll talk about soon. But like the match, and I know our super producer John Gennaro had mentioned it last week, I think, but the one I would wonder if there's any matching, anything that lines up with is between Indiana and Brooklyn, because you look at Dorian Finney-Smith, you look at Royce O'Neal, some guys who like fit into that 3-4 mix and just like,
Dan, not to interrupt you, but I am interrupting you. Who was Dorian Finney-Smith's last coach before he was a member of the Brooklyn Nets?
It would be Rick Carlisle with the Dallas Mavericks. And so he has like, that is a guy that made his career in Dallas. He was one of the rare exceptions to the rule of like, he was a young guy that earned his way into the mix under Rick Carlisle with the way he played defensively, with the ability to thrive in a sort of narrowly tailored offensive role, but just like add and get better at that while taking on any defensive assignment the Mavericks needed. Like he was one of Luka Doncic's favorite teammates, a guy that Luka absolutely loved and was very upset to lose, although it did come in the context of the Kyrie Irving deal. Like there are tea leaves to read and dots to connect there. Whether there's a deal that actually makes sense for what Brooklyn is looking to accomplish with the trade at the trade deadline, whatever that actually is, I'm not entirely clear on what the goal would be for the Nets at this trade deadline. But that's kind of where I would be looking. Even if I'm not saying that Dorian Finney-Smith is like on the level of OG Anunoby as a player, but that kind of addition to like OG Anunoby is not the kind of player that all of a sudden you plug him into your lineup and as the Knicks have seen, they're just all of a sudden outscoring teams by a point a minute with him on the court. Like it's about how that player like raises the floor overall, like the multiplier effect of, oh, now we're not that bad at this one spot that hurts us. It kind of elevates everything else. I wonder if someone like Finney-Smith could be that kind of guy for the Pacers. And then if you're talking about all, you just got to like survive the Halliburton absence for 5-6 games, a couple of weeks. They've already won 2 games in it, which is a really nice sort of staying afloat for the Pacers. You do that, you add somebody that kind of papers over that major defensive deficiency. And if you can get even to like 20th in defense, like we talked about with Caitlin Cooper on Divine Intervention last month, like if you just get to be like, not even average, just like bad, regular bad on defense, that's a team that could win a series and really make some noise. So that's where I would be wondering if I think you're right. I don't think their plans change, but I wonder if their target has to.
I'm going to live fact check myself. The last coach Dorian Finney-Smith played was played for was Jason Kidd. He was already there. But the connection, right. but we knew the connection remains. The connection remains.
It was spiritually true. Absolutely right.
Spiritually true. Well, I mean, spiritually could be true because Rick Carlisle lit a match to Jamal Mosley on the way out of Dallas, if you recall, and put out a statement saying that they should hire a coach at the time who was not part of the organization. That was a wild exit that I will never forget. Never mind that. Now, the Knicks, as you were talking about, they are in the injury news now on a positive side, being that there's now optimism, according to our buddy Fred Katz at The Athletic, that Mitchell Robinson might actually be able to return from ankle surgery later this season. I mean, it was definitely a surprise when the news first came out that the Knicks were applying for a disabled player exception in Mitchell Robinson's spot. But now the NBA has denied that because there's the thought he could return. So could this impact New York's trade deadline? I would say yes, on a minor level, being that as the Knicks had been looking at backup big options, you know, there are guys on the market right now like Daniel Gafford in Washington, who I've definitely heard the Knicks had dialogue with Washington about. And even someone like Wendell Carter, who I don't know if the Knicks and Orlando, I cannot confirm that they've had talks about him, but Wendell Carter continues to be a name that a lot of league executives talk about as a potential trade candidate this February, being that Goga Batase has done a phenomenal job starting for Orlando in his stead. Mo Wagner is arguably a top six man of the year candidate coming off the bench. And there was thoughts that New York could potentially look to add a backup big guy type behind Isaiah Hartenstein, who was their backup behind Mitch, who's playing also phenomenal in his starting role, that maybe the guy they got would have potential starting caliber abilities and move Isaiah back to a reserve role. That was kind of a thought out there. Like, could it be Gafford or Wendell? It depends on who, like, how that all would have worked out. I think if there is a thought that Mitch is coming back, it would probably, would likely eliminate having that like three guys who deserve or could play 25 to 30 minutes in your front court, one of them collecting dust on the back of the bench in MSG. I would think that probably diminishes their aggression to go really try to spend capital on like the top tier reserve big men, because I always like to look at the NBA, I'm sure it's this on this show, I always like to look at the NBA transaction cycles as like those elementary school type tests where one of them was the column A, column B thing, and you draw a line across, and like sometimes that's the trade deadline. Sometimes there are things on each columns that are extra that don't end up lining up, versus like the draft, there are trades that might or might not happen, but there is 1 through 60, like those things are happening, and having those data points to figure out definitely is helpful for people such as myself or people in front offices to try to figure out what is going to unfold, because there's an actual order that's taking place. With this deadline, one smaller detail that I definitely am picking up on is it seems like there's a ton of teams in the market for backup bigs this year. Like off top of head, New York, Boston, Houston, I keep hearing, are definitely three teams. There's others too, but I don't have that note in front of me. And those are the three I'm most confident saying off the top of the noggin. And I wonder how competitive that market will actually get. And I wonder if that impacts New York's, oh, well, if the bidding for this guy is this high, well, we don't really necessarily need that now because Mitch could come back. That's my long rant.
It makes a ton of sense to me. I mean, well, first off, like any big move the Knicks can make right now, it's like you might want to be careful because it's like don't fuck with a winning streak, right? You know, like the way the pieces fit together right now feels like making any significant adjustment might be a little bit, unnecessary. Or if you're going to make a big swing, you got to make sure it's for the right person. And maybe backup big does not necessarily constitute a big enough swing to upset the apple cart, but I can understand feeling a little bit reticent to go out of your way or bid up to the top of the market on something that, you know, if things are going the way that they're going, like the Knicks might already be the third best team in the East, you know, like depending on how other teams sort of navigate things. I think the prospect of Mitchell Robinson coming back. Mitchell Robinson was playing fantastic basketball when he got hurt, and the Knicks were one of the few teams that were, that could reasonably say, like, we have 48 minutes of very good center play while without that center being like a central piece, like a huge high usage piece of the offense. Isaiah Hartenstein has been fantastic in a larger role. I think the idea of being able to have both of those guys capable of playing a larger role on any given night, depending on what the, you know, how things line up, would be fantastic, or foul trouble, whatever. But I think it's also like optimism that Mitchell Robinson could be back. Like, it's worth pumping the brakes a little bit on it. Just like when the Knicks first announced that he was going to have surgery, it was December 11th. The reevaluation timeline was 8 to 10 weeks. That, you know, 2 months out, a little 2.5 months out, that puts you at like late February, early March. And just like, so being cleared at that point doesn't necessarily mean Mitchell Robinson's like ready to be the guy who was playing that fantastic basketball in October, November, early December until they get Knicks get to the playoffs. So like, it's possible that you don't want to make the move because you feel like you've got those boxes checked, those bases covered, but the Mitch you get at that part of the season might necessarily be the one that elevates you to that top three, top four conversation. But man, yeah, I mean, given how good the Knicks defense has looked since bringing Anunoby on board without Mitchell Robinson, the potential to add him into that mix is really, really enticing, and, you know, puts the Knicks in maybe allows them to operate from a position of strength as they go into this deadline, as opposed to feeling like, well, we're just one piece shy and we got to go get it. Like, maybe they kind of feel like that piece is already on the way back.
There you go. Who's not on the way back, unfortunately, is Ja Morant. Out for the year, torn labrum. Disappointing. Dude was balling. The Grizzlies were coming, man. Everyone in the West was shaking in their boots. Not really, but they were hearing the footsteps. They were hearing the Grizzlies climb inch by inch back up the standings and making their way to the TM play-in push. And now they're not gonna. It's a bummer. It really is. And it's definitely led a lot of people to think, okay, well, does this now make Memphis a sneaky seller, where they are already at the bottom of the West, looking up at the play-in picture, really could just be a couple losses away from being in that muck with San Antonio. And I just want to sound the caution, pour cold water on the idea that like Marcus Smart is going to become available, because before the season, or before Ja came back, when the Grizzlies were plodding away and not winning many a game, there was a lot of hope, I think, from rival teams that maybe Marcus Smart could reach the open market. But at that time, when I spoke to Memphis folks, that was certainly not the case. For the longest time, they had been talking about Jaren, Desmond Bain, and Ja as their big three untouchables. Marcus Smart was, at that point in time, like back in the December 15th time of the trade season, was being listed and considered right with those other threes as a bedrock part of this foundation. And what's been pointed to me by a lot of other executives is that, I mean, Memphis gave up a lot for Marcus Smart. If you really want to think about it, they put out Tyus Jones, who had been the stabilizing force for whenever Ja had been out, which was a lot over the course of his first couple of seasons, his rise to superstardom with injuries and stuff. Before all the off-court antics became a thing, Tyus Jones was that extra piece that was the best backup point guard in the league, but they allowed him to go to Washington to have this opportunity to run a team with the Wizards, and they gave up 2 first-round picks to get Marcus Smart back from Boston. I am skeptical that he's going to be someone that is going to be actually for the taking. Just like I'm skeptical Zach LaVine gets moved, just like I'm skeptical Pascal Siakam gets moved, which is leading me to our last tradey piece, or at least, I mean, we'll talk plenty of trades probably with Golden State, but in this trade bouncing around the league portion of our show, I'm starting to think DeJounte Murray might become the best actual player moved between now, we're recording this January 11th, and the trade deadline, being that we already saw Drew Holiday, we already saw Damian Lillard, we already saw James Harden, OG Anunoby traded before the calendar even flipped 2024. So if you think about trade season and the overall transaction period, where a lot of teams come into each calendar year, each 22, 23, 23, 24 campaign with, you know, the Lakers right now, they have one pick to trade, for example. This is our level up card we can play. A lot of teams, Boston, Milwaukee, the Clippers, they have already kind of played that card. So it makes sense that there might not be a ton of teams that even have the capital to send out, but also a lot of teams think they can win right now, and a lot of teams don't have actual all-star players available for the taking. So DeJounte Murray being A, available in Atlanta, B, just 27 years old, C, having a career year with real all-star production, and D, having signed a four-year, $118 million extension this summer that pretty much everyone around the league is considering below market value, it's making him a very intriguing trade candidate. I do think Atlanta's asking price at this stage of talks, from talking to other teams, is being considered a little bit too high. But that being said, I think he's got the widest range right now of legitimate interest from around the league. And I think he has potentially the greatest chance of anyone actually getting moved, being that Pascal Siakam's contract stuff that we talked about is just scaring off a lot of teams with the fears that he would be a half-season rental and he could just get traded and turn around and reach the open market and go sign with Detroit or some, you know, underdogs team that has a bounty of cap space that is willing to give him the maximum contract that he wants. So I'm keeping an eye on DeJounte Murray. A lot of people around the league are keeping an eye on DeJounte Murray as being like the difference maker that could get traded this season right now that's left to be traded, being that, as I said, there was those four other guys that are out there. And the teams that I've come up with as five legitimate landing spots for Murray right now are the Knicks, the Lakers, the Sixers, the Heat, and the Pistons. The Spurs stuff I've heard for sure, I don't think that's necessarily legitimately going to be an outcome. I haven't heard DeJounte wants to go back there. And my impression on the whole is that I don't think the Spurs are exactly enamored with the idea as an entire organization about bringing DeJounte back either. I've heard the Nets a lot. I think that's an option that him and his representation would like. But I've been told pretty definitively that doesn't seem like to be a thing on the vision board in Brooklyn right now. And then the Warriors have come up in other people's reporting. I just haven't heard that yet. And it doesn't make a ton of sense to me either, being that they have their own cap complications. And while DeJounte stuff is a little bit cap conscious, being that his deal is considered below market value, still adding on a $30 million basically average annual salary isn't the easiest chip to move when you're in Golden State's position. So with all that expository, Dan Devine, of the Knicks, Lakers, Sixers, Heat, and the Pistons, which one of those teams do you think would be your preferred landing spot for him? Because I have one. I think mine is an outside the box answer. But I mean, it's in the box. It's on the board, so it can't be that outside the box. But which team of those would you want to see Murray play on?
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're going outside the box, you've established a box of five teams, and you're going to be like, yeah, actually, he's going to go coach the Tide. He's going to Bama.
He's going to Bama.
I think the one that makes the most, in the context of what we had just talked about with the free agency discussion and the likelihood or relative unlikelihood of the major difference maker being available on the market there, I wonder if Philly is the most, like, the neatest answer here. I was actually thinking about Philly when you started to say Marcus Smart. I was like, oh man, I wonder if the Sixers could get in on him. But then, you know, as you mentioned, unlikely that anything's going to happen there. But the idea of an all-star caliber combo guard, could play point, could play off the ball, who is not like a, you know, $50 million a year kind of player, and who might be able, like, welcome an opportunity to be on a good team that the infrastructure around him makes more sense, but also get opportunities to cook. I think what we've seen from Philly, especially this recent stretch where Joel Embiid has been injured and out of the lineup, is like there is the need for a third creator there, because when the Sixers have Tyrese Maxey off the floor, the offense has just died. And so the minutes where you have both Embiid and Maxey off the court, ideally in the context of a playoff series, you're not going to have very many of them. How often have things gone ideally for Philadelphia in the course of a playoff run? In those no Embiid, no Maxey minutes, the Sixers are scoring 112 points per 100 possessions. That's from cleaning the glass. That would be the 25th ranked offense in the NBA, right around where the Wizards are, which is not where you want to be if you are a team with championship aspirations. So maybe that's only a few minutes a game when it matters most, but if your offense dies in those few minutes, that could make a big, big difference in your chances of getting out of round two, making that long playoff run that Philly's been waiting for. So I can see that lining up in a way that makes sense, like the context of how Philly's been playing, of the way the market seems to be shaking out for the offseason, and the way that Murray's market seems to be shaking out. But I'm guessing that your answer is different than that.
Yeah, I mean, you raise a great point. And the Sixers have been clear on a couple things. They want to only use their draft capital, if they do it, on a two-way guy. And they definitely want someone who can help with that creation void that's lagging behind those two in Joel and Maxey. And I've also heard from some other teams, maybe, I mean, it's funny, like when you hear the same thing from other teams about one team saying this to other teams, if people are following along with all that, it's definitely like a bit of a whisper down the lane. So it's always fun to like then go back to the actual team and hear what their perspective is. But I think there is definitely an idea in Philadelphia that if you were to get someone who could both fill that void, but maybe even be the point guard when he is sharing the floor with Tyrese Maxey at times and allow to maximize Maxey off the ball a little bit, I think that's an intriguing opportunity for them too. So he would make some sense. And we've kind of talked about that on this show a little bit. I remember talking about it back when I was recording in Vegas. So I do like the fit there, but the fit I'm most intrigued by and what I want to happen, I'm here to you, talking to you, Dan, through a computer, opening my heart and opening my arms to bring DeJounte Murray to the Detroit Pistons. I want it to happen. Okay, I want it to happen because
we'll go behind the scenes a little bit. We have a rundown. We go over sort of what we're going to talk about, and we know we have the opportunity to make notes and kind of sort of put our research in or whatever. And when I saw the Pistons show up on this list, I just wrote down for who, for what, to what end. So, Jake, Sell me on this idea.
So for who? I mean, I think any outgoing package right now where the Pistons are getting a legitimate all-star such as a Pascal or DeJounte, I think Jaden Ivey is probably top of the list for other teams. I think Ausar Thompson will be ruled as off the table from the Pistons side of things, being that they just selected him. And Ivy's already had a bumpy start to his time with Monty Williams running the show there. Obviously, he's been playing and starting a bunch of late, but I think for who, this is my educated analysis, that Ivy, I think, would be a real name to keep an eye on as part of going out the door. For what and for why? Like, I've been afraid of the Knicks using the picks that they saved for Donovan and saves from Donovan and saved in the OJ deal to just send him for DeJounte and try to recreate what's happening in Atlanta and New York. Like, I don't think that makes a ton of sense to me. I understand why the contract is appealing for teams, and he is very, very good. And in theory, he could play next to Brunson. But with Detroit, Cade Cunningham isn't the on-ball dominant guy that we've seen Jalen Brunson and Trae Young be. And Monty Williams has been flexible in figuring out and experimenting different ways to get him off the ball and different partners for him when he's on the ball. And talk about that combo guard ability. Cade is also 6'6", 6'7". He's not the more diminutive point guard that we've seen him with in Atlanta and that we could see him with in New York with Jalen Brunson, to where there's more of like a cleaner defensive fit of him guarding true ones on the other side and kind of sparing Cade from doing that, even though I think that has already kind of been the plan with Detroit. And he's a floor spacer. Like, if you're going to have someone such as Cade be a heavy, a high usage engine in a lot of high pick and roll with your young center of the future in Jalen Duren could help to have a guy who's a real floor spacer. I mean, Murray is, I believe I saw yesterday, 38.4% from deep this year, which is his career best since his rookie year, and he's shooting a lot more and playing a lot more. So I'm counting this as like his real career high. I just think the fit's interesting. I think it really changes things in Detroit if you can flip it. I mean, you're kind of hoping Jaden Ivey becomes what Jonte Murray is if you're taking him fifth in the draft, which the Pistons did. So I kind of like the idea of just like snapping your fingers and Pokemon evolving him and putting him next to Cade Cunningham overnight.
Yeah. I mean, I can understand the Pistons saying like, sure, let's get somebody good here. I feel like if I'm DeJounte Murray, I wonder if I look at that as being sort of sent to Siberia and, you know, a difficult situation, but he doesn't get to control that.
Detroit versus everybody, me and Cade, we got this. That'll be the take.
Yeah. I think, I can understand that. And I can understand if you're the Hawks saying, well, this hasn't worked. Let's cycle this out and like get a high, like a second draft kind of high upside option in Ivy, who everybody loved coming out of Purdue. And there was, you know, we feel awfully far away now from the discussion of like, man, the Kings blew it taking Keegan Murray over to Jaden Ivy yet again.
Hey, that was a dumb discussion at the time because it wasn't clear who was better. And the Kings were adamant. The Kings were kind of laughing, honestly, about how people were laughing at them for not taking Keegan Murray. And they're thinking of him as their, you know, next branch to keeping this contending window open in Sacramento for a long, long time. They ain't training for Pascal Siakam. They ain't training for nobody. So the Kings have always been there on Keegan, man. So I think that conversation was a little bit weird back when it started. And don't bring it up again now. Not on my show.
Fair enough. My apologies. Your show. Interesting. Okay. We couldn't do this show without your first mate on the NC Armada. And yet here we are. The shooting component that you mentioned, I think is interesting. Like it's what would make DeJounte a really neat fit with the Lakers. I mean, I guess that and the clutch aspect of it, but he's shooting, you sort of split up the components of his shooting. You're absolutely right. Career best shooting for him. 39% on catch and shoots. A little over 40 on pull-ups and also like 48 from mid-range. So like you have a Lakers team that is devoid of bankable shooting or has very, very little of it. He would be a nice fit there. You imagine that the defensive stuff, you know, I think of DeJounte Murray as a good defender. I think a lot of people think of him as a good defender. In reality, the defenses have been bad in Atlanta since he's been there. And it's not, I mean, that is a systemic Trae Young frequently at the center of that issue, although Trae Young has picked it up on that end to some degree this year, had a really nice strip at the end of regulation on Wednesday night as the Hawks went into OT and got a big win. But maybe DeJounte Murray with his size, with his frame, with the demonstrated ability to be a high-level defender that he's shown in the past, maybe he'd play up in a Lakers structure that is, you know, much bigger, has Anthony Davis behind him, has, you know, great size and length and, you know, a better activity and scheme around in that structure. I think the question for me with the Lakers is, though, is like, you mentioned they have one future first round pick that they can trade. Is that like, was it 2029? I forget what year it is.
2029.
But so like, is that, can the Lakers sort of build a big enough deal or is it worth like, would the Hawks want that pick enough to take back whatever matching salary on like an underwhelming asset the Lakers would send back, whether that's D'Angelo Russell or Rui Hachimura or whoever. And then if not that, like, can you make it a big enough deal? It's like a, you know, a financial institution in crisis. Like, is it too big to fail if you add in like D'Lo and Rui and like Max Christie or Jalen Hood-Schifino and the pick and then like get back Marie and like Bogdan Bogdanovic? Like, is there a version of the deal that gets the Lakers multiple shooters that help with their structure? And is that another one of those classic like LeBron James mid-season take care of all family business, get a whole new half a roster in that elevates that offensive ceiling for LA? But like, could you make that worth Atlanta's while? I wonder if there's just sort of a disconnect in what the Hawks would want back from that. Because Detroit, yeah, you mentioned that deal and it's like they get a high end prospect back from it. the Lakers, I don't know that there's enough sort of in the cupboard to get that.
Yeah, I've been told that if Austin Reeves was put on the table, the Hawks would have much more interest, naturally.
Sure.
But to your point, I've been led to believe that if Austin Reeves were to be going out the door, being that the Lakers have adamantly told teams, we are not moving Austin Reeves, I think LA would have to have more, such as Bogdan Bogdanovic come back with DeJounte Murray. However, I think that'd be a little too rich for the Hawks blood for my conversations. Yeah. So there will definitely need to be a lot of back and forth. There will be a lot of back and forth over the coming weeks, I think.
Actually, one second before we get out of DeJounte, I know we've been going for a while on it, but the Heat, we didn't talk about the Heat with it, and I talked about the Heat a little bit with Rohan Nadkarni on Divine Intervention on Tuesday, but I'm wondering, like, my first blush thought on Miami as a fit there, I'm like, if I'm the Heat and I think I have a shot at Donovan Mitchell, and what I have to deal to get DeJounte Murray knocks me out of the mix there, is it worth my while? And my first blush thought is no. What do you think about that framing? Is that like the wrong framing for a deal structure?
Yeah. Or do you think of it as, if the Cleveland Cavaliers are going to be in a position where they're trading Donovan Mitchell, do they really want all the draft capital that they gave out for him? Or would they rather have a combo guard like DeJounte Murray as a major cornerstone centerpiece coming back? I mean, now we're thinking like four steps down the road.
Right.
But yeah, when I first heard that, I thought, okay, sure. Like, the Kyle Lowry upgrade has been something that rival teams have been thinking about dating back to last trade deadline. Salaries definitely match up when you look at the extension. DeJounte's only at 18 right now. So a little bit of chicanery that has to go there. But yeah, if just like how Toronto wanted players over picks for OG, right, and it seems like the case with Pascal, Cleveland wants to win. They want to win now. They have this core three plus Donovan that they think, you know, core four, I'm making a little tickle. That was a pot shot that they think are right there at the top of the East as they were the four seed last year. I think getting someone like DeJounte back would, as the quote unquote, the centerpiece, I think that might be even more intriguing to the Cavs. I mean, I'm saying that on January 11, 2023, when this might not even ever be a scenario, but
right,
I think come this summer, if that were to happen, or even come next trade deadline, because Donovan does have 1 year left on his deal after this, the thought is, well, the player option after that, he'll might decline. And then so Cleveland might have to look to do things sooner rather than later. But yeah, to wrap that up, I think DeJounte could be an interesting piece to come back. So, I mean, he's someone right now, last stat, I got texted this morning by somebody, some propaganda for you. Over his last five games, DeJounte averaging 26.5 on 53 from the field and 52 from three. He's scorching at the right time when his name is pop around the league. And with that, we get to our last segment of the show. We are vibe checking, bringing the vibe check back.
It's been a while.
It's been a while. And it's been a while since the Golden State Warriors have been an actual good team in the NBA.
The vibes are rancid. Next segment.
It pains me to say, because there's a lot of people that in that franchise that I like, and a lot of players in that franchise that I like. And I'm going to a road trip to be not disclosed right now in the coming weeks. Partially because the Warriors are going to be there, and shout out Raymond Ritter. I know I'll be able to get some work done when you're there because you're great at your job. But the Warriors have not been great on the court, man. They are now 12th in the West after a blowout loss to Joe Garza's Pelicans. They're behind the Utah Jazz. Remember when the Jazz were really bad and Larry Markkanen was hurt and everyone on the team was for sale and they hated John Collins again and blah, blah, blah. And now they're awesome. The Jazz have won 9 of 11, I think, and they might make the play-in tournament at this rate. So the Warriors, it's just, I don't know. I'm going to end my, Dan, what's this? Give me the temperature of the vibes that you're seeing in Chase Center right now.
The temperature is plummeting. It's frigid. The vibes are ice cold and, you know, colder than a polar bear's toenails. It's disgusting. It's bad news. They've lost 6 of 8, starting with the Christmas loss to the Nuggets. They're 14th on offense, 19th on defense, and those are trending downward. They've been outscored by 1.6 points per 100 possessions with Steph Curry on the court. The Warriors have not been outscored in Steph's minutes in more than a decade, 2010-11, his second season. So, like, it's about as bad as it gets. Yes, Draymond Green is on his way back and he's returned to practice. No exact return date set yet, but soon. Chris Paul broke his hand, might be out. It was from Jeff Stotts at the Great Injury Focus site in Street Clothes. There's some variability based on which hand bone was involved, but the average missed time for in-season surgery for a metacarpal fracture is 42 days. So that could be, I think, end of February, but past the trade deadline, maybe potentially compromises his availability as an expiring contract in those discussions, you know, TBD. Jonathan Kuminga, Moses Moody, like the two remaining lottery picks from the two timelines era are both mad at their minutes and usage and opportunity. Jonathan Kuminga, like, I think Jonathan Kuminga might be like on the lower end of a player who could get the report of like has lost confidence in his coach. That's normally a star kind of thing, not Jonathan Kuminga level, but Jonathan Kuminga, I can't blame him for not being super confident in his minutes and his opportunities. We talked last week about like he actually looked pretty good and then didn't play the last 18 and a half minutes of a loss. And then you're wondering where you stand in the rotation. Moses Moody continues to have inconsistent minutes and opportunities, despite being like the only guy who seems to be producing the last couple of games. It's just like all of it feels like no, it's all built on shifting sands. And it feels like everybody's just kind of, you know, falling into it. And like, no one's really sure exactly how to get out of it. Except for Bob Myers, who got out of it. Better to leave a party early than to stay too late. And he got out and had a little pit stop at ESPN. And now he's with the Washington Commanders and, you know, seems like his stress level is going to be reduced a significant amount. Good on him. But where we look from here, like Stephen Curry's asked after that loss to the Pelicans, you mentioned, you know, the blowout loss to Joe Garza's Pelicans, not even the Dan Devine writes about your team curse could derail the Pelicans. That's how bad the Warriors are right now. And you get asked after the game, Steph Curry gets asked, like, the trade deadline's coming up. Does it feel like you kind of have to move forward, try to make something happen here? And his quote was, "We have a standard. It's pretty evident that if things stay the same, that's the definition of insanity, right? You keep doing the same thing, but expecting a different result. If the Warriors keep doing the same thing as presently constituted, Draymond or no Draymond, I don't think they're going to get dramatically different results. They're not getting enough offensive support for Stephen Curry. You're seeing more frequent instances of Steph just not being able to shoulder the entire load on his own. The defense just has not been good enough. You're not getting consistency. Andrew Wiggins being like has basically just gone from second best player on a championship team to like, how is this guy getting minutes in the NBA on a lot of nights? And so you're talking about a team that seems to be in desperate need of a shakeup. The question though is like, if you're another team around the league, like what are you? A, you know you have them over a barrel, and B, what do you even want coming back from a team that looks this dysfunctional?
Yeah, the Wiggins point is salient, being that he's the obvious outgoing piece in terms of his salary, in terms of the fact that other teams could, in theory, think other teams, you know, we mentioned the Pacers earlier, could think of him as an upgrade. And it's hard to do that right now when he can't find the ocean from three-point land, and he can't play next to Kuminga. It's been like one of the bigger challenges, I'd say, that Steve Kerr has been battling with in Draymond Green's absence, being that the Warriors have always thrived with, let's just put rangy wings on the floor with Steph and figure it out, and they can't figure it out anymore. I mean, to me, like last year, is this the last dance of Golden State type stuff? Like, this is the last dance of Golden State. Steve Kerr is in the final year of his contract. I'm not saying that this is going to be Pete Carroll, Bill Belichick, Nick Saban situation, but it's in the water, man. Yeah, it's in the water.
There's an end of an era vibe kind of swirling across high level sports. And, you know, this would not be a shocking addition to that, I guess.
It wouldn't be, especially being that, you know, throughout every head coach, front office, partnership, there's always going to be things of, oh, there's been some discrepancies on who the coach wanted to draft versus who the front office wanted to draft and minutes and whatever. But it just does seem like from taking the pulse on things, there's been more of a disconnect between Steve and the front office this year than ever before. When, to your point about Bob Myers now helping the Washington Commanders, like the guy who hired Steven was one of his closest allies isn't there anymore. Not to say that the front office like hates Steve Kerr, but right. There isn't the same type of symbiosis that there had been in the past. Interestingly, like across the aisle, because everyone was talking about Kerr and Spoelstra together, Spo's situation couldn't be any more different. Him signing an 8-year, $120 million extension was like the least surprising thing possible. But I'm wondering with guys like Kerr, who are not in like a hunky-dory, everything's working out great situations, like before Spo's contract, I was starting to wonder if the Monty Williams deal and the Greg Popovich deal that came before it this summer, and everyone in the coaching world was like, hey, this is great. We're getting paid now. Well, then Monty Williams went off and helped compile the largest losing streak in NBA history, and Greg Popovich wasn't so far behind that their 18-game streak. And I was like starting to get worried for all the coaching buddies out there that maybe that new benchmark wouldn't necessarily be the case. I mean, Spoh's is an argument against that, but Spoh's a different beast, man, and the Heat are a different situation. So I just, to bring it back to Golden State, things are definitely going to look different after the trade deadline. Like, there's just no doubt in my mind. I think the only guys that are like truly, truly, truly untouchable there are Steph, Pods, and TJD right now. Like, I'm not expecting them to trade Draymond and Klay.
We simply can't consider Brandon Pajemski and Trayce Jackson-Davis to be untouchable. We simply can't.
I'm not saying like they're going to never trade those dudes, but like right now, when your timeline plan never worked out, like I think you've got two rookies who are actually doing stuff right now on rookie deals that will be very valuable if they can continue to be rotation pieces with expensive stuff, all the CBA stuff we've been talking about throughout the show. There's just very little chance they'll move those guys. I would put Draymond and Klay right behind that crew because, like, sure, man, there is definitely a lot of sentimentality around that organization of, let's just keep this band going one last time, one last dance, one last ring around the rosy. But I don't think that anyone else should be off the table, like from Wiggins on down. I mean, the Chris Paul injury was interesting, unfortunately for him, from that trade standpoint that you mentioned, being that, look, like, I think there's no way the Warriors traded for him without the thought in their mind, if this doesn't work out, he's got a great movable deal. And I do think he was playing well enough where he could have been really interesting in a lot of places. Like, if that was the move Philly did, right? I'm just putting a need in a player that's theoretically available together. I'm not saying that there were talks between the Sixers and Warriors, but I do think with Daryl Morey's connection and knowing how he's always run things, there's no way he wasn't at least considered along the list of point guards that Philly is putting up on the board and having scouting meetings about and talking. Like, Miami is a match for Kyle. There would have been, I think, plenty of teams that would have. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of opportunity. At this point, I don't know exactly what Golden State is like looking for, because I don't think they even have, like, the Pacers have this defensive-minded four they're looking for. I don't think the Warriors even have that, because it is such a bad vibes situation going. I mean, the thing that is sticking with me when I'm just thinking about the scene and like, write what you see and what we're feeling about a team, the Pistons game the last couple of days, I forget when they played them, but like Steph went off in the fourth and was just hitting step backs, and it wasn't even an issue, and the Chase Center's going nuts, and it felt like man, this is what it was always about with Golden State. Like, it didn't matter. You had Steph to uncork and he was going to light everything from outside and it didn't matter. But like, he had to give that and he had to give everything he had, and the Warriors had to give everything they had for the 3-win Pistons on their home floor. Like, if you really squinted and looked at and like blurred out all the edges, like back when they did on the TVs when HD first came out, and on the old channels that were in HD, like to fill the space of the HD TV, you know, they blur the corners. Like, it's just Steph doing Steph things. But if you zoom out and think about it, the Warriors need everything they can to win any game right now, even though Steph Curry is playing at the MVP caliber levels that he's been playing at well into his past his prime. I mean, can we even say that? Like, it seems like his prime is still ongoing. Right. That's tough. It's really tough right now.
I think the main takeaway is if the Warriors are an SD team in a 4K era, and it's the picture is not particularly sharp right now. A couple of just sort of stray thoughts off of that. You're absolutely right. Like, if this is not a where one move from everything lining back up kind of situation, like you need multiple pieces to help solidify your defense. If Wiggins is just not going to get better, if this is not going to get back to where it needs to be, then you need like multiple pieces to solidify the defense. Draymond plus help. You need another source of shot creation with Chris Paul being out of the lineup for, you know, the foreseeable future, and then some, because the offense wasn't like humming without that. And you need like a blood transfusion essentially for what has just felt like a toxifying situation. So getting all of that done with limited enticing pieces in a short window is an awfully tall task. And, you know, I wouldn't want to be in Mike Dunleavy's situation, because that seems like an awful lot to try to get done. And if you don't, you bear the responsibility and the frustration for, well, you just wasted a year, Stephen Curry. And, you know, whether that was your fault or not, you wind up holding the bag, which is why Bob Myers is someplace else right now. second thing I thought about that was, I forget which movie it's from, but that along the line of like, things end badly, otherwise they wouldn't end. I mean, this is kind of, it feels like we're getting closer to that in Golden State right now. And if we want to bring the podcast all the way back up to the top, you mentioned on the coaches, you know, the coaching market, and saying like, was the Monty Williams contract like the Rudy Gobert trade of coaching salaries? And did it like blow everything up in a way that everyone was like, no, it's not going to be like that anymore. Don't worry about it. Then Spo gets his deal. I have to imagine that the happiest man in the ranks of NBA coaching is Tyronn Lue, who has his team absolutely operating like a championship contender, and who is going to be up for a deal pretty soon, right? So he's got, and who just got his main guy extended, maybe has the number two guy on his way. Kawhi is saying, my understanding is everyone's coming back, and you're walking into the new arena with the richest owner in sports, and you just watch the market get set again. Everything coming up Ty Lue right now. Also, just for fact-checking purposes, thank you, super producer John Gennaro. That quote is from Cocktail. There we go. I apologize for not having it at my fingertips, but the good news is John is barely paying attention to what I'm saying outside of that. So he's got that at the ready for us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much to everyone who listened today to this episode of No Cap Room here on the Ball Don't Lie Podcast Network. Thanks to John Gennaro for all the things he does, not just fact-checking Dan, to make this show look and sound great. Please subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube and whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on, and leave us a 5-star review. That would be so, so great. We thank you for listening, and we'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.